I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. The author Jeffrey Blunt joins me now. He has just published his third novel, The Emancipation of Evan Walls. It has won a number of awards already and tells the story of Evan Walls covering his life as a child in 1960s Canaan, Virginia, wanting to overcome the racism and class status imposed on him by being black. The book goes through Evan's formative years through to the 1990s when he and Izzy have a daughter. At that point, Izzy, who doesn't know much about the challenges Evan has endured, finds out. I'll get Mr. Blunt to tell us as much as he'd like about his book, its genesis, the other characters and the themes that are discussed in the book. Why is acting white such a problem in the black community, and what is acting black enough all about, and why does that perhaps preclude education? It's good to talk to Jeffrey about America today and race, as he covers both in the book. Jeffrey Blunt has written two previous novels, Almost Snow White and Hating Heidi Foster. He is an Emmy Award-winning director and a 2016 inductee to the Virginia Communications Hall of Fame. In his 34-year career at NBC News, Mr. Blunt directed Meet the Press, The Today Show, the NBC Nightly News, and major special events. Visit his website at jeffreyblunt.com for more. The Emancipation of Evan Walls is published by Kohler Books. We taped this interview late last week with Mr. Blunt joining me from Washington, D.C. Please welcome to the Blunt Online program, Jeffrey Blunt. Mr. Blunt, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. How are you coping with COVID-19?
We are doing well. My wife and I are home and, in the house most of the time. We do take a couple of walks a day, and I'm taking the opportunity to do some more writing, and so we're hanging in there.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I was reading up on Twitter about, because a lot of us are self-isolating, a lot of us are able to take the time to, not have to work.
Yeah.
It's a great privilege. And that's something that we don't talk about, and that's a theme in the book, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's definitely, many of us have privileges, and we don't recognize it. Those who don't have them and who do recognize it, like Evan Walls, have a battle, have a struggle to get to, but they deem it a worthy struggle. And in Evan's case, people are out to keep him from making a successful run at that.
So Evan is, I guess when we meet him, how old is he?
Well, when we meet him, he's an adult. He's in his mid-30s, and he and his wife have just had their first child, and he is basically terrified by the fact that his child might be like him in terms of being an oddball, unsophisticated, or wanting the wrong thing at the wrong time and rubbing people the wrong way and basically not having any friends and not having, a life outside his home. And he's really afraid that what he has gone through as a child will transfer to her just through the genes, and it's a very difficult situation. And he hasn't told his wife about much of his youth. And he decides, or she talks him into telling her at this point, because she says, I can't help you help our daughter if you don't tell me the whole story. And so at this point, we go back to young Evan at 10 years old, where he makes a declaration that he wants to be somebody, never understanding that that declaration would take him on an incredibly difficult emotional and physical journey.
I understand the inspiration for the book, Jeffrey, was from a newspaper article you read about a 10-year-old African-American boy who was being bullied because he was going to school.
That's correct. And he went by, from everything I could tell from what the reporter was saying, he's a brilliant kid, got fantastic grades, and he paid for it. And on his way home, kids beat him up for it. And it seems like the most ridiculous thing. We all were going to school. We all want an education so we can better ourselves. But in the morass of race relations in this country, the mixed-up, crazy world that race has created, Evan ends up being told that he is doing something that is white. Becoming educated is white. And this boy was being told the same thing. So Evan is 10 years old in the book when the flashback begins. because this boy in the article was 10 years old at the time.
Yeah. We're going to jump around because the book does jump around too, doesn't it?
Yes.
When we talk about Evan and Izzy and what it was like growing up in Canaan, Virginia. In terms of the expectations that people have, I mean, it's when we think about it, I mean, it's absurd to think that you know, a person's acting white, and so maybe they shouldn't, or they're not being black enough.
Right.
That's a problem that is quite prevalent in not only in America, but I think it's here in this country as well. It's not being discussed as it should.
No, it isn't, and it's a taboo subject. And my attempt to break that taboo is this novel. And I think it's a deadly taboo subject. As right now, kids are taking their own lives because of it. Middle school kids are committing suicide because they're being bullied to the point that they don't know what to do. And so it's time that we brought it out and looked at it and considered what it's doing to the community and do something about it. There's a television show, ABC, in the United States, does called Blackish.
Right.
And they did a story on colorism, which they knew would be a bit controversial. And at the very end, they say, we did this because we wanted to have a conversation about it because nothing gets fixed in the shadows. And that's what I wanted this book to do, was to bring this conversation out because it is in the shadows. And while we're doing nothing, children are taking their lives and are getting beaten. And we're losing the intellectual capacity that they could bring to the world. We're losing the gifts that they could bring to the world.
Yeah, one realizes as well just how insidious it is and how casual it is. I had a fellow on the show about a year or so ago and from the United States and one of these old showbiz types. And we were talking about all the people that he worked with in television and the sort. And I'm 38, and people are often surprised that I know things. People in vaudeville even, and so you get that sort of patronizing
right.
tone about how do you know that?
And then, I read.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I get from time to time is why do you know that you're not white? My parents are Filipino.
Yeah.
And so, I look Filipino. But people wouldn't know that.
Right.
If they didn't see me. And so doing the show as I have over the years, it's over the phone as we're talking today. Sometimes when people meet me for the first time, they're surprised that, I'm not white. I mean, I've had that told to me more than once over the years.
So have I, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's the part that I think is the most poignant as we're talking is just how casual it is and how just, how does one react when that's being told to them, at a dinner party or something like that,
Yeah, well, it's a very difficult thing. Part of this book is my life. I've certainly had to deal with that. Michelle Obama writes about it in her recent memoir.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of people have dealt with it. I think one of the ways I've tried to deal with it in on the book tour and talking to people is to try to explain where it comes from in some cases. And it sort of helps to put it in perspective in that, let's say, in the South, where I grew up in Southern Virginia, and on tour I found out it was like that elsewhere. Even after Brown versus Board of Education, and which said that schools should be integrated mm-hmm. and we should have equal education, it wasn't until late 1969 that I went to an integrated school. I grew up going to segregated schools. So you had black schools, you had white schools. Black principals and black educators were in charge of the daily curriculum. I'm not sure that they were setting total, but day-to-day they were in charge of curriculum. Schools integrate. Those black principals get demoted or fired. White education professionals take over the curriculum. And they create something called a tracking system. At the very top, of course, are white students. At the very bottom are black students. And we know that many of those black students belong at the top, but we're sent the message that you're not, you don't belong there. You weren't even born capable of being there. And so at a certain point, you either accept the fact that you are intellectually inferior and were born that way, or you reject that notion and you reject anything and anybody that has to do with it. And so if you end up at some point being the one or two or three black kids who end up in that top tier, then you have moved into the wrong neighborhood. If you make friends in that top tier, then you have become the ultimate sellout and Uncle Tom. Mm. And anything that happens up there, including good grades, including going to college, including all that stuff, gets labeled as a negative, as acting white. And that's what we've been fighting going forward. And that's what Evan Wall's life in the book is all about. Evan's proclamation is that he wants to be somebody, and he will go to school with anybody, white kids, whoever, if he can become somebody, if he can live up to his intellectual dreams. And he has no idea that his own community would turn against him. He would certainly be, in the late 60s, any black child would expect, in the South at least, where I grew up, white people to say you're inferior. But they wouldn't expect their own community to say, to turn against you because all you wanted to do was to get an education.
So what are some of the things that Evan is told by people in his own community, his own family even, in terms of his goals and how they view him?
Well, I found on tour that one of the most important parts of the book in terms of how readers have reflected is in the first chapter when Evan is on the porch, which, you know, the porch is it's like another church in the South, and he stands up and he makes this proclamation. And all of these, his family, friends of his parents, adults, look at him and try to put him in his place. And they say, what do you mean you think you can be somebody? You're going to be just like the rest of us working on the farms or working in a meatpacking plant. And why do you think you can be any better than us? You're just going to be like us. And even one person says, and she says, you know, I know what being somebody is around here for black people. And little Evan says, I don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And she says, an N-word by any other name is still an N-word, and that's what you're going to be. So all they could see was to tell him that he was going to be what they had already internalized about themselves. He could not rise above the lack of faith they had in their own abilities and what they internalized, that, you know, the idea that they were nothing and then belong, they shouldn't be more. And so they kept pushing that on him, and he had to fight against that. And luckily, Evan has a couple of mentors that recognize what he's trying to do and are willing to help him. A lot of the kids who are taking their lives today and are struggling with this don't have those mentors. Mm. But the reason why Evan has those mentors, why I put them in the book, is because I want to show people that here's a problem, here's a way out, and one of the way out are the mentors and people who recognize that these kids have gifts and that they're special and that they will do anything to help those kids live up to their dreams.
What drives Evan in terms of motivating himself to get beyond where he is even have the idea to not settle for I guess his heritage even or what he's used to?
Right. Well, as his great-grandmother, Mama Jenny, says, you know, little colored children, as they said back then, grow up early, and they learn to see early the bad things around them in the world, because at a certain point, even if it's just by osmosis, you learn what the white society, the controlling society, thinks of you. And you learn where that places you. And you can do that without even people having to tell you. You just grow up in the environment and it happens. But most of the time, at least for the people I grew up with, they knew that. And so you make that assessment, you see what's going on, and then all you have to do is have a spark, which Evan had. And it's the somebody who recognizes that there is light beyond where you are. And you can see the frustration in your family and your friends and the lives they have and the struggle they have. And if somebody shows you the light that there's a way to get beyond that, being 10, 11, 12, 13 is not too young to recognize that there's a way out. And Evan sees that. And he sees it through the eyes of the character Bojack, through his great-grandmother, and through this powerful figure of a high school principal and mentor that I think, so those characters really give him focus and carry him forward.
The importance of mentorship, that can't be understated, because I think anybody who is who's successful or even just leads a life of meaning, when they look back, realize it's because of these people around them that help, and it's often people we don't realize sometimes.
Right, that's true. That's very true, and it, you know, I had that situation in my life. I mean, one of my great mentors. It happened to be I was working at my hometown newspaper, scraping floors and taking out trash, and I eventually wrote a letter to the editor about something at school, and I turned it in there. And the next thing I know, he made me a cub reporter at my paper and became a lifetime mentor. You know, I spent 34 years working at NBC News in Washington, D.C., and I ended up going on that road into journalism because of Mr. Edwards, and who's still in my life today. And it was a very, very important mentorship. So it is important. And it's also important for those mentors not only to just show where kids can go, but also show that, and particularly African Americans and the kids like Evan Walls, that history shows that there are many people like them who have been intellectual giants, doctors and lawyers, and even Katherine Johnson, who just passed, who we know. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are all these names of people, all these points of light that kids need to know about and be pointed toward. And Evan was given that. And even given that, he still had a formidable struggle to get to somewhere that he felt safe. And even then, I try to let the readers know that he is still scarred. And this is what, and the reason why I do that is because I want people to know that it isn't, you know, bullying in high school or bullying in middle school and people get past it. It's a lifetime effect. And it changes how people even deal, how they live within their own community.
I've only read, I guess, about a quarter of the book so far, and even then, I can see just how informative Evan can be as a sort of example, as a mentor even. Are there things about the character that I guess you learned as you were writing the book?
Oh, absolutely. I learned, I try to, and this is, you know, having mentors and people who I love to read and listening to authors talk, try to let the character breathe a little bit, and even though I know I have a storyline, I want to give them room to surprise me, and I think that's a good thing. And I can't remember who said this now, but it was you know, no surprise in the reader, no surprise in the author, no surprise in the reader.
Mm.
So I try to allow for that surprise to happen to me. And that happened a lot with Evan. It happened in, you know, his relationship. He has a relationship with a girlfriend that you'll get to later. A large part of that was something that I hadn't planned. And also, there this principal that I was talking about, Eliza Blizzard, who is a formidable character in the book, I had not planned Evan's relationship with her the way it turned out. And I think it turned out so beautifully that it did surprise me.
Well, why do you think that happens? I mean, I don't write, but I talk to authors all the time. That moment, because it is a solitary moment where you're working, you're writing on a book, working on characters, plot, and it takes you somewhere where you didn't expect it. I mean, it's a almost magical moment, isn't it?
It is, and it's like, so if you're watching a movie and something is happening and you think, okay, I know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, sure.
This is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's that you sort of get, you come with writing, it happens the same way. You're getting to that point, you're writing, you have this sort of, I do like a chapter synopsis, or I have what, I'm in the middle of this where I'm, or it's supposed to go, and then a light bulb happens. Said, wait a minute, what if this happened, and he wants to go here? And you should be free enough, at least I like to think most writers are free enough to let that happen. Sometimes it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You just rip those pages up and go back. But oftentimes it turns into something beautiful.
The other thing that struck me as I'm reading the book is just how elegant it is, and it seems for I know it's work and I know it's hard work at times. It seems effortless the way it the way you put the words together. Does it come easily to you?
Yes. I mean, I work hard at it, like everybody else. You know, and there are many different edits and different versions of the book. But I love writing, and it isn't. You know, I retired from work at NBC, uh-huh. And I write because I love it. I don't consider it work. I consider it almost a mental health process for me. And because of that, I think it's like I'm able to get my head in a place where I feel like I'm creating music and or some other kind of art, and it flows. But at the same time, I think as a painter would go back and touch up or paint something out and paint another thing on top of it, you realize that the art continues to grow, and every time you look at it, like I just finished a couple of chapters on I'm at the end of the third chapter on the next book, and uh-huh. I just set it aside for a few days, and then I know that when I go back to it, it'll change because I'll see different things. But I love the process, and I love creating the characters. I love writing it, and there's little better than the feeling of having a really good day of writing, and when it's done, I just feel whole.
And how do you schedule your day? Did you have certain hours that you have to work, say, a certain time of day?
Well, now that I'm retired from NBC, I mean, I can write when I feel it. So I get up in the morning, I work out every day, and I take my time sort of getting my head into it. I use music to as a kind of a trigger. I sort of pick some music to go with every book that I'm writing, and, uh-huh. and I will use that music, and it gets my head in the right place, and then I can sit down and write. And when I was working, using the music was great because I didn't have as much time to, like, take a walk around the block and think about where I wanted to go today. I needed to sit down and write. So I would listen to this music. It would put my head in the right frame of mind. I'd read two or three pages, the previous pages that I'd just written, and then I was ready to go. So I've sort of trained myself how to get into it. So I'll do my workout. I'll walk around a little bit, and I'll sit down, and I'll write until I know that I've done my best for the day, and then I'm done.
What were you listening to when you wrote The Emancipation of Evan Walls?
There is the trigger song was a song called Hometown Hero by a group called Megan Jean and the KFB. I should say a duo, a husband and wife. And it's a very, very powerful song about why you can't really go home and why hometown heroes have such trouble. And so I would listen to that sometimes, you know, three, four times to get my head in the right place, and then I'd read my few pages and go right into it. And in fact, I quote from that book in the beginning. You know, when you open up the book, there's yeah. a dedication to my wife, and then I quote from Hometown Hero, and that is, "Don't take it to heart, don't let them break you, baby child, and pity the mouths as they try to unmake you." Mm. So it meant a lot to me. So, and I called, I sent an email to the artist and asked for permission to use that, and they gave it to me.
Now, the book follows Evan's life,
yes.
And so it's a large chunk of time that it covers.
Right.
You mentioned a moment ago about early in the book, we also meet Izzy.
Yes.
Evan and Izzy have a child. So at that point, what, Evan's in his mid-30s, is that right?
That's correct.
When he looks at his daughter, and, I mean, there's so much in that scene that you can see just, you know, without even dialogue, that's coming to the fore in terms of what Evan's thinking about his own life and his daughter's inheritance from him. That's another thing we overlook is how much of trauma or history or heritage comes from our parents or ancestors, and that gets transferred through the generations even if we don't know it.
Right.
And so I guess Evan wants to do something because, I mean, he realizes that it can be problematic later.
That's right. And in fact, it's a good point that you raised, because I have gotten quite a few emails through my website asking if I was going to write a sequel about Jenny, his daughter, because they want to see what she does and if his worries come true. But yes, you do carry a lot of those things forward, and I think that if any of us have had that kind of emotional trauma that Evan has had, and if we take on to us the idea that we've sort of created some of that trauma by who we are and what we desire to do, then you'd be fearful that your kids, like you said, would have those same needs and those same desires and would feel that in the way you lived your life. And if they were as bold as you are, if that's something they got from you, then it may cause you the same problems, cause them the same problems that it had caused you. And he's quite worried about that. And I think it's sort of a dramatic point in that in the first part of the book where Izzy, you know, just says, I can't help you help her unless you tell me this story. Mm-hmm. And then him coming to the idea to agree with her that, yes, I have to do this not only for my health but for my daughter's health and for my marriage.
Yeah, one wonders why they'd gotten into a relationship, Evan and Izzy, without her knowing.
Well, that'll be answered for you.
Right. Okay, there we go.
I won't spoil that for you.
the other thing I noticed is when you were still doing appearances for the book, unfortunately, coronavirus has stopped that for not only you but a lot of authors. One of the things that you've talked about in your appearances are the barriers to education in America.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just the attitude, say, of people themselves, but there are institutional roadblocks. There is institutional racism that has not been addressed even in the year 2020.
Absolutely. And what I try to leave with people is that while Evan's story is important and I'm raising the flag and saying, hey, look at what's happening over here, look at these kids, and I'm talking about this particular thing called acting white, it exists because of institutional racism, and we cannot ignore that. And this whole idea that I spoke of the tracking system was a part of institutional racism. So they had said, okay, we're going to have integration now, but we've also found a way within integration to segregate. And those kinds of things continually cause problems in the progression that we're trying to make in having equal education so that, you know, we don't have this kind of lingering effect. But there is no doubt that that institutional societal racism are the reasons why these problems, why this book is able to exist. I talk sometimes about the race tree that I say was planted 400 years ago, and there's a limb for unequal education, there's a limb for unequal housing, there's a limb for medical care, and there's a limb for something else, and each one of these limbs have tiny branches that go off, and all of that is... we look at it, we can see when we look at that tree the progression of how slavery and race and Jim Crow, everything else, has affected the lives of African Americans and white Americans in this country and has created the legacy that we are trying to overcome today.
And when you look at history, when you look at the trajectory, if you will, of 400 years, and you look at where we are today in 2020, I mean, it's hard to be hopeful, but are you at the end of the day? I mean, do things get better, do you think?
Yes, I am hopeful. And the reason why is because I did grow up in I was born in the 50s and the late 60s in the South, and there is no doubt we have come further than where we were when I was born. And what it proves to me is that the greater group of Americans move towards, as Dr. King said, the arc of justice, the arc bends towards justice.
Mm.
And if the greater amount of Americans did not move in that direction, we wouldn't have made the progress that we have.
Right.
And I still think that is the case. I think, unfortunately, we're in a situation right now where people have been allowed to, you know, bring out some of those kinds of negative of views of race, and it's in, you know, the number of hate crimes and all kinds of stuff is on the rise, and that is you know, it creates a perspective for us now to see that we still have work to do. Mm-hmm. But I'm hopeful, given the breadth of change that has happened in my lifetime, that we can continue to do that. And I do see that in the lives of my children. Both my children have multicultural friendship groups. Mm. And I love seeing that, and have loved seeing that as they grew up. And I think that is a promise. And so I do look forward to those things. There was, I always remember the phrase that a lot of people used to say. I remember my my great-grandmother saying, when, you know, when you talk about how tough it is for African-Americans back in Jim Crow and those times where, yeah, she knew, she was born in the 1880s, and she said, well, you know, black people continue to have children, so there's hope. And they continue to have children generation after generation for the hope that our children will have a better life than we have, and that this life will have many better things to offer them. So I am very hopeful, and I think even at the very end of the book, and I spoke about Evan's scars, mm-hmm, I think that people will leave Evan with hope.
You'll indulge me for a sec here, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
In your 37 years at NBC, you worked in Washington. I guess you worked closely with Tim Russert, didn't you, on Meet the Press?
I did. I worked with Tim for 10 years on that show.
I never went to J school, so anything I learned about interviewing came from the people I watched or listened to, people like Imus and obviously Tim Russert.
Yeah, he
was a marvelous example, not just as an interviewer, but as a personality. I mean, when you talk about his Catholicism or you talk about Buffalo, was he the same guy that we saw on TV off the air?
Yes and no. I mean, he was, how should I say, a raconteur. He was a larger-than-life figure off the air, more so than on the air. And I know that's kind of strange to believe because he was quite a figure on the air.
Yeah.
But, you know, what you saw, the Buffalo stuff and talking about his dad, you, yeah, know, he'd wear these ties with you know, at certain holidays and play with those. And, you know, there were, you know, he had a big voice around the bureau and that sort of thing. So he was a larger-than-life figure everywhere in our lives as employees of NBC in that building. But he was so respected for his ability and his journalistic ability and his preparation, uh-huh, his research, and his ability to, even though, you know, he worked for Moynihan and he came out of the world of politics, but by the time he unfortunately passed, people looked toward him as an equal interviewer, or, you know, he would put everybody under the spotlight, yeah, no matter who you were. When you came to, you sat at the table on Meet the Press, you had better become there prepared, because he was prepared. He would be prepared. And we all took pride in that, and we put on a great show, and tried to put on a great show to, you know, to elevate the show, to elevate him, and to, you know, do something in our own way for journalism. And we did. We took that show from a half hour, number three, when, yeah, Tim started, to an hour, to number one with no competition.
Yeah.
So it was a great time.
Is it true that he would recite the questions on the set off before, you know, like even the night before?
Well, we would have a rehearsal on the show, before the show, and it was, and a lot of it was for me as a director, because you have to really be in sync, or as much as you can, with a live show with your moderator, because you have all these elements. You know, Tim, uh-huh, would say, well, you said on Friday, and you'd have to go over to that tape and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So what he would do, you know, he was a lawyer, so he'd say that lawyer thing, never ask a question that you don't know the answer for. And so before the show, he would sit down at the desk, and we would sort of go through the show in his mind. He would say, I think I'm going to start here, and if he says this, I might go here, or if she says this, I'm probably going to call for this graphic on that. And so he would just walk through the show in his mind. And then we sort of follow along and sort of take hints. And then when we went in the show, he would sort of do the same thing. So he would wind up a question letting us know based on the rehearsal that he's going to ask for a certain tape or he's going to ask for a certain graphic so we could get there in time. But yes, he did sit there and go through the show like he envisioned it happening.
Well, when you watch what's going on politically now, I mean, it's hard to not think of what he would think of where we are today.
He'd be very disappointed, I think. You know, anybody can surprise you, but I think he'd be very disappointed in so much of where we've gone, and particularly in terms of the constant conversation rather than reporting. Mm-hmm. And he was very much into being a news journalist and being based on fact rather than conversation. And that's where we've gone today. So that's my opinion of what Tim would be thinking today. Others might have different opinions.
Do you miss not being in that bureau now?
No. No, it was, you know, coming from being a boy who grew up on a small farm in southeastern Virginia, it was a long trip to get to there. I was the first African-American to direct the Today Show, and there was a lot that went into all of that. It was a busy career. I did things I never thought I would be doing. I found myself in places, you know, in the Oval Office chatting with presidents and things like that I never thought would happen. But live television is a incredibly intense way to spend your time. And I feel like I did my time. I did it well, and I retired feeling really good about the job I'd done. But it was time for me to move on, and I have no regrets. I don't think about, what if I was back during this story. Now, my wife was a correspondent for ABC News, mm-hmm. and then 20 years at CNN.
Right.
And I think the reporter brain maybe is a little different in that she still gets excited by the big stories and sometimes thinks, oh, you know, if I was there, I'd be doing this. So, but not me. I've moved on.
A lot of us in this country have watched your wife, Jean Meserve, on CTV in recent months, right?
That's right. And yeah. and that's one reason why you can see she's still moving forward. She's she's traveling the globe. She's moderating panels on national, international security around the world and speaking and has loved being on CTV. So she's staying in the game.
Well, one of the things you mentioned, 37 years at NBC, and one of the things that I've in preparing for our chat have noticed is that mentorship was very important to you when you were there, and I can't help but think, you know, the parallels to the book in terms of how you viewed it. It was never a job for you. It was something that you were there really to find people and mentor them as well in your work, right?
Oh, absolutely. I have quite a few. I have a stack of nice letters and cards from folks that you know, I have participated in their career, I like to say, and helped move them along. But you know, people did that for me too. I remember in one particular incident, I was talking to a friend of mine and saying what I wanted to do. And there was this director, his name was Tony Verdi, and he was like the god director we all looked up to. And she said, well, you should just go tell Tony what your dreams are. And I was like, yeah, right, I'm going to walk in his office. And so, but eventually I did. I walked in his office and sat down, and he said to me, well, you know, Jeffrey, what can I do? And I said, well, I wanted to tell you what I want to do, and I would like for you to help me get there and mentor me. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I would like to have your job someday. And he took me under his wing, and not long after that, he was directing something big down at the White House, and at the time, I was an associate director. After just going in and sitting down, he called me up and said, you're coming with me to the White House. Mm-hmm. And right after that, you know, and so I have always taken the opportunity to where I had the ability to reach back and offer the same kind of hand that Tony offered me, and over that period of time, I've been able to do that a fair amount, and I've had some great relationships, and there are some wonderful young reporters on the air right now who I worked with and helped train, and So I feel very good about that.
Was writing something that you always wanted to do? I mean, live TV probably doesn't afford you much time to say write at your desk, but even growing up, was the idea of writing novels, was that something that you wanted to come to later on?
Yes, writing was something I wanted to do, definitely. I learned when I was in high school, and just writing in English class, that I had an ability to use words that could move people or that could make people, you know, stop and listen and reflect on what I had written. So I had always loved writing, you know, but I grew up on a small farm. I grew up in a very small town. There weren't a whole lot of, you know, it didn't seem to be a whole lot of avenues for African Americans to do a lot of things coming out of there. So my first goal was to acquire some sort of ability that I could go out and make a solid career and do something that it was exciting and that I liked, but that would, you know, afford me the opportunity to make a good living and raise my family in a comfort that a lot of us didn't have when we were growing up. And so that was the first focus. But I always kept writing. And my first book was written in the early 90s, and that was when Gene was actually at bureau duty for ABC in Israel for about 6 months that I worked on that book. Uh-huh. And so I would come home every day after work and do nothing but write. And then I also, a friend of mine, Joe Cortina, Cortina Productions, does a lot of museum work, documentaries, and other things that happen in museums. So I would write scripts for films, for short museum documentaries with him.
Right.
I have two in the African American History Museum. I have six in the Muhammad Ali Center with him. So I was writing all along the way, and it wasn't until I got closer to the end and that I found my agent, Marley Russoff, that we really got into Evan Walls, and the writing, you know, kind of took over my life.
And you mentioned a moment ago that you're working on the next novel, is that right?
Yes.
Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, I'll tell you that it's about whether or not we can find redemption in this life. Bryan Stevenson, who I don't know if you know, is the Equal Justice Initiative in the South here, and does a lot to help get people who are on death row, who shouldn't be on death row, help mm-hmm. get them off. He has a quote that is, and I'm paraphrasing, it's that we are more than just the worst moment we've had in our lives. And so, and this story is about a character who is a larger-than-life character that we all know on television and so forth, has an extraordinary fall from grace. And in the era of social media, are you allowed to ever redeem yourself? Can you redeem yourself if everything you've done is always on Twitter, and every time you try to make a step forward again, Twitter blows up again, uh-huh. or, you know what I mean? Are we able to get rid of the scarlet letter today? And so that's what it's about, and it's also about this character trying to find that way. And again, like in Evan Walls, there's a mentoring thing in here. Is he able to help the people that he finds himself living around bring themselves back, and then at the same time bring himself back? So redemption can be found, but it can be found in different ways than we think of. You know, we think of, well, will society at large accept us? But maybe we don't have to think that big.
Yeah.
Redemption can come in a smaller way.
Well, until that book comes out, urge people to read The Emancipation of Evan Walls. I can't wait to finish the book, and I've kept you longer than I said I would. I could talk all day with you, Jeffrey.
Okay.
This has been great fun. Congratulations on the book. Continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The book is called The Emancipation of Evan Walls. It is published by Kohler Books. JeffreyBlunt.com is the website for more. Jeffrey Blunt joined me on the line from Washington and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.